Welcome to Unstructured Unlocked,
a podcast where listeners discover how enterprise leaders are confidently automating document intake and accelerating their workflows to increase capacity and drive top-line revenue.
I'm co-host Michelle Gouveia.
And I'm co-host Chris Wells. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, welcome to another episode of Unstructured Unlocked. I'm your co-host Chris Wells.
I'm your co-host Michelle Gouveia.
And today we're joined by Dan Fajella, who is the CEO and founder of Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here with both of you.
Yeah, feelings mutual. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your background and maybe a lot about Emerge and what you do?
Yeah, sure. I'll do the quick version on both here. So my background is really just as a market researcher in this space. So I've run and sold a number of companies, but been focused primarily on Emerge here for the last 8 years. So the way to think about us is we're a publisher and market research company focused on the ROI impact of AI in the enterprise. So primarily kind of Fortune 1000 companies are the people that we interview. We've done something like 1,300 podcast interviews over the last 8 or 10 years. And a hell of a lot more surveys than that. And so every year we've got, this year will be closer to 2 million than 1 million. So maybe 1.6 million downloads to the AI and business podcast. It is the big show when it comes to B2B AI. So if you think about NVIDIA's podcast and their giant market cap, we do have a larger listenership than them. So just for context. So we cover and touch on what the buyers are doing. So think about CIO, Goldman Sachs, head of AI, Raytheon. These are the kind of people we're talking to. Yashua Bengio was just on the show 3 weeks ago. So these are the kind of people we talk to. We get a sense of what the buyers are doing, where they're moving their money, what they see the future as in these different industries, banking, insurance, retail, finance broadly, manufacturing. And then we also talk to the unicorn vendors. So your AWSs and Dataikus and that whole ecosystem as well. So talking to the buyers and sellers, we get a lot of insight. And we serve a broader executive audience that's interested in that stuff. So that's sort of our day-to-day work.
Awesome. Michelle, we're only like 1/26th of the way there.
You're getting there, guys. Cranking along.
I know. I was these stats are impressive.
Took forever. There was no tricks for podcasting. It was just consistency from a very long time ago when nobody was listening. So same journey.
So 8 years is like an infinite amount of time in the AI space. So I wonder, before we jump into the questions proper for the interview, if you just tell us, like, what have been some of the high watermark points along that journey?
Yeah. 10 years ish ago, we started seeing kind of initial venture sniff around interest with AI, right? Back then it was very silver bullet buzzword only kind of stuff. You could raise a, couple million bucks with just kind of the buzzword with the right froth on it. China came out with their AI strategy. The ball started rolling. The venture ball started rolling. Not a lot of enterprise value, a lot of misconceptions on the founder side and the buyer side. But that was sort of like an exciting place to see things kick off. Five, 6 years ago, we had kind of a chatbot craze. I don't consider that a high watermark. I think that was kind of like an embarrassment period. But then we had, we could call it good or bad, but sort of a lot of money flushed its way into the system sort of around the COVID times. And we went from a world where a company in AI with 100 million raised was like really weird to like a company with 100 million raised was like regular, like a normal company, like nothing really special about that. That gave companies go-to-market juice to start to work on contracts, that gave companies more ability to hire folks and deliver more value. So during that same period, we saw enough kind of tentacles actually get stuck in enterprises where, hey, this is not just an innovation project that's going to get killed next year. This is something that's going to hang around and, be rebuilt for year after year. So that was an exciting time to kind of see the tentacles really kind of find their way in and make this something that really is not going to go backwards. Like AI is not going to get pulled out of life sciences, pulled out of banking, pulled out of retail. Now we've got this big wave of Gen AI, which from my vantage point is drastically underhyped, if anything. I think if people understood the bigger picture consequences, in the coming 3 to 5 years, I think they would be absolutely shocked. So I consider this wave to be gigantic and those are three exciting times. So we have one every now and again, and we're certainly in one right now.
So then that last point you made is actually not the perspective we hear a lot, right? Yeah. And so I'd love to understand how you think about, like, how is Gen AI different than other versions of AI that have, that you just kind of alluded to that have crept up over time, both from usability, opportunity, capability. Yeah, I just would love your general thoughts on that.
Totally. So just for context here, and I'm almost certain this is recorded, or, you know, at least the slide deck is up there publicly. 6 or 7 years ago, I was at Interpol in Singapore, their big sort of innovation kind of offices out there. And they wanted to talk about AI in kind of a surveillance context. I gave them like 3 slides on that. And they spent the entire presentation talking about what I called, like, there was AI for detection and AI for creation. So generative AI was not a thing, by the way. But there were early demos with NVIDIA where they would take a certain number of slides of a video and then try to guess the next 6 slides or something. Or take a, you know, and somebody walking and then sort of simulate, you know, what does their gait look like? If they go behind a wall, where are they probably walking based on where they were walking before? Really early proxies for this stuff. You know, a car driving in a scene and then sort of generating what the next turn to the left would look like, what the buildings would look like, all of that. This stuff was tinkering around 6 or 7 years ago. New from the jump would be astronomically consequential. The reasons I think this stuff is sort of consequential, I'll get into a few and you can drop a pin in whatever you're interested in. But there's a lot of directions here. So one of them is, I will say, from a business value standpoint, if the technology, the core technology, didn't develop at all, and we didn't develop any new hardware, hopefully we'll bring some more compute online, but if we didn't develop any new hardware, and if the core tech of sort of LLMs, let's just say on the image, video, and tech side, the code side, didn't develop any more than they were right now, we froze the tech. Never happened, by the way, but let's just pretend that happened. With that simply making its way into core enterprise processes, I think that the real vision of actually overhauling what underwriting looks like, overhauling what inventory management looks like, overhauling what marketing functions look like, I think that vision that everybody thought they were doing 10 years ago, right? The first wave of AI, we're going to rebuild the call center. The founders didn't know what the hell they were doing. The buyers were so immature, it was ridiculous. That was never going to happen, right? 10 years ago, never going to happen. But it was the vision, is let's build it from the ground up with kind of AI at the core. I genuinely think a lot of Gen AI, if we froze it, if it just had the time to sink into the soil, the new companies built from the ground up with this entirely different ballgame. Personal opinion. We can go deeper on that if you want. Second, this stuff is really accessible, right? We're doing simple prompts, we're conjuring relatively complex things. We're doing prompts to conjure the code itself, which is tangibly different. I think everybody since the founding of sort of enterprise AI would always like to say, "Oh, you don't need just to have data scientists; anybody can use this stuff." Kind of, man. Kind of. I mean, that's really not the case. Hasn't been the case. Isn't probably going to be the case in the super near term, but I think there are more Gen AI tools that are more genuinely just usable out of the box. So in terms of that last mile of getting the person in XYZ position to use the damn thing, I think there's some big advantages there. And I think there's a lot more experimentation and tinkering that can happen when anybody can use the stuff. So that's number two. Number three, where this takes us from a human condition standpoint is pretty consequential. So from my vantage point, said this many times, you know, if anybody wants to Google my name and, you know, go back 8 years or whatever, very, very long standing vision here, that we're moving into a world of very much an audience of one. So if all of you were to freeze, sort of like look at your screen time history for the last decade, probably it stayed around, I don't know, 12, 14 hours a day. But mine can easily be 18 on weekdays, especially, but even on weekends is pretty high. That probably hasn't like lifted drastically because you guys have been working on computers forever, right? What's changed is percent screen time, where what is on screen has been conjured to you by an algorithm, TikTok, Netflix, Google, the things you're like, would this pop in my damn eyeballs with AI? Yes or no? The answer increasingly is no. Increasingly, the answer is no. And so that curve doesn't look like this, right? You've already capped out your waking hours on the screen. You live like a monster. You could tell your great grandparents how you live right now. You'd be either a monster or a god. You live a sick life. You're staring at glass all day long, right? Seriously, it's jarringly different than the past, mm-hmm. but we don't feel like it is. This curve is popping. Now, where that curve is going to go is most of what we're interacting with is conjured for us for the first time from an algorithm. So instead of us, oh, I want to see something funny, let me scroll through random funny analog videos that exist, I will have relaxation, education, entertainment, and AR layers over reality. Do I want the view outside my window in Western Massachusetts here or Weston, Massachusetts? Or do I want to see a medieval castle outside? Do I want an eagle flying through the sky? It might be more relaxing for me, more renewing, more interesting for me. Do I want reality? Or do I want whatever is going to keep me focused, make me feel relaxed, make me feel excited? Whatever my desired goal is, nobody really wants reality that much, I would argue very ardently. And we want what we want from reality. We want the state change. We want to feel a certain way, get a certain thing done, whatever the case may be. And so living in a swimming circumstance of hyper-conjured and tailored experiences is, I believe, absolutely to be the norm. And I've been on record for this for the vastly better part of a decade. And I think we're starting to close the gap where people care. And they're sort of seeing the beginnings of that. But if they knew where we're going to be in 5-10 years, if AGI doesn't consume us, then I think they would like be shocked, because the change from your grandparents to us, where we live like monsters and gods on screens all day, that's about to be compressed. And we're going to live wildly different, completely programmatically conjured experiences moving forward. So those are the three reasons I think this is tangibly different from previous waves, and that I believe it genuinely to be underhyped most of the time.
I have so many questions and thoughts.
Yeah, that was great.
I'm going to filibuster here for a minute. If you had to pick a technology, in fact, two technologies, in terms of impact on society, and then second, in terms of risk to society, what two technologies historically would you compare this to?
You know, it's really tough. I have a whole, and these are all like, again, this is all 7-year-old stuff. I had like zero readers on my personal blog until like 6 months ago, and people were like, when Bengio was like, it might be smarter than us one day. Like for some reason, it took those guys a long time. The nuke analogy is an old one. It's very old. Very old analogy. I don't think it's apt. I don't think it's apt. I think it's okay, but I don't think it's apt. So nuclear, again, we can have great power and, fulfill some of our needs as a society and civilization. We can also destroy ourselves. I think with artificial intelligence and with where things I think could go, and there's a really handful of, let's call them non-stupid people, who are of the belief that it's pretty reasonable between now and 2030 to kind of cross the post-human threshold. So you look at a guy like Jeff Hinton, it's just hard to make the argument he's dumb. You can call him whatever you want. You don't have to say he's handsome, but you can't say he's dumb. You're not allowed. You're not allowed to do it. Same thing with Bengio. Unfortunately, guys, you're not allowed to do it. You might not like his haircut. I don't know, but you can't call him dumb, right? And so these guys believe that sort of the post-human sort of transition may very well be in the coming decade here. That tilt, I think, does have the potential to lead to the sort of destruction of society and of sort of humanity broadly. So I think there's a nuclear correlate there. I think it also has the ability to sort of unlock all kinds of splendid and wonderful things. Ooh, we could cure all the diseases and yada, yada. And maybe there's a way we could harness it and have it mostly treat hominids in a good way. Although Hinton is very skeptical that let's call it intellectually superior species would spend all of its time shackled to a lesser species. You know, we've never seen it. Yeah. So could it be hypothetically possible? That's questionable. Is it morally right? Unfortunately, that's also questionable. I hate to say it, even though we're hominids. I'm actually quite glad I don't serve sea snails all day, right? I don't wake up in the morning and look to like roly-poly bugs and be like, I'm going to spend all of my time and resources optimizing your life. No, I pave over them to build a hospital, right? Because hospitals are important for us as a humanity. That there's a shot, and it's a toughie, but there's a shot that's a horse pill for us as well. But there's the potential it would bring about great benefits. The weird thing about AGI, should it be sentient and be able to do the things that maybe a Hinton purports it could do. And again, this is Hinton, so it's not Dan's sci-fi ideas. These are the guys that invented the tech, remember. It would be sort of a blossoming of intelligence upwards. So nuclear could make our lives better and could destroy us, But you can't set off enough nuclear bombs where an intelligence beyond man populates the galaxy and does brilliant, sparkling things as far beyond us as we are beyond earthworms, right? That doesn't happen from nukes. So AI is correlative in the danger and benefit sense, but it's not correlative in the genuinely intelligent sense, in the sense of kind of a furtherment of evolution, which again, even the Hintons and Bengios themselves kind of see as potentially what this is.
Nor in its origins, right? We developed nuclear for war, and we developed AI for Will Smith eating spaghetti.
That's why we invented it. Yes, the original AI conferences up there in Dartmouth, they were like, "There's going to be an actor. We're going to have all kinds of videos of this guy eating spaghetti. It's going to be great.
It'll be great."
But yeah, no, certainly they started from different positions, although the military. DARPA, IARPA, I'm sure was a pretty big part of like before the last AI winter, I think a lot of the dollars actually came from there. But it cooled off and now it's been kind of academic and tech that's doing not just all the innovation in AI, but all the innovation generally, right? What's the percent of R&D that's funded by the government now versus back then? It's a different universe. You're right that the funding is also coming from a different place. That's a good point.
The other thing I was going to say, just a personal anecdote, I was speaking at my kid's middle school career day, talking about careers in AI, and two things came up. I mentioned, you know, some of the thinking about, you know, clicking your Roku remote and asking for a mashup of the Avengers and Roblox or something, right? And
it just 100%, brother.
And the kids were fascinated. The teacher had never used ChatGPT. And I was afterwards, she pulled me aside and she was like, "Why are you telling these kids to use this to do their homework?" And I'm like, "Because they're going to have to use it to do everything in their job by the time they make it to the job market. So like, you can put whatever restrictions you want on them, but you're hamstringing them."
Absolutely. There's no argument around that one. Yeah, I'm totally with you. Go on if you have more there, but I think
I was just agreeing with your point that it's pervasive and in that sense a very different wave. So let's come back down out of the clouds and talk a little bit about given the audiences that you get to interact with. What are you seeing in terms of executive interest, and is it deeper than the CEO with shiny object syndrome, or is it just another flavor of that?
There's definitely a ton of that, but I do think that it's combining with other things. So shiny object AI was also 7 years ago. We still sort of had some of that stuff. Chatbot shiny AI syndrome was 5-6 years ago. There's an element of that again. A couple things feel different for us. And again, we talked to a hell of a lot of the buy side. Just, you know, you see the podcast, it's like VP head of C-level Blue Cross, fucking Johnson & Johnson, you know, you name it, right? So we see that over these last better part of a decade, there's been a lot of spend in kind of dark corner, little popcorn projects in little random places, spinning up technical debt within legacy enterprise. I think some companies have learned, A, maybe a little bit about how AI works conceptually from some of those painful lessons. But B, they've kind of learned that treating it as popcorn projects forever maybe isn't a good thing. And they're looking at this new technology that is sort of inherently, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, a flat kind of horizontal shebang. You don't look at LLMs and be like, "Oh, it can do that one thing." No,
right.
It can do that many things is what it can do. And so people are naturally being forced out of, can it just solve my inventory problem? Can it just solve my customer experience problem? And they're sort of being forced to be jarred and maybe even reminded that AI is a capability. So I think there's been the hard lessons of the first silver bullet phase of thinking about AI, I think hopefully taught at least a handful of lessons. And now they're faced with a technology that's inherently more wide reaching. And so they're more proactive from our vantage point in asking about two things that used to have to be force fed. So for many, many years running this company, again, like appealing to ears and eyes of the executives is the only way we run the business. We have to connect buyers and sellers, which means you got to get the buyers on board and you got to pull them in. So it was not strategy and data infrastructure that would pull in enterprise people 5 years ago. It just, they would have to learn about that stuff. They'd say, "Man, I want to solve this inventory problem." Great. You'd have to get them excited. And then sort of introduce the fact of, think about building this as a capability that is something that feeds into sort of what you're going to become here. You know, something we can actually stand on and develop, rather than sort of a dark innovation project that just helps with this one sort of like add-on system or whatever, just spinning up technical debt. You'd have to kind of introduce them to that idea, or introduce them to the idea of, hey, improving our sort of data infrastructure is going to be necessary to make this happen, right? That came as a shocking, jarring, annoying surprise forever and ever and ever, and every vendor had to deal with it. And they still do. I'm not saying it's gone, but I think we're now seeing more buyers ask overtly about strategy and data infra, and more overtly see this as a capability layer. Is there still plenty of FOMO hoopla? You better believe there's still plenty of FOMO hoopla. But I think we're sitting on so many dead bodies of projects that failed and people that have learned some hard lessons, that the fluency is a little bit higher. So this hype wave is hitting with a bit more fluency versus just pure ignorant hype wave, which is a completely a recipe for wasted dollars. Still going to be some wasted dollars here. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. We especially see that with the startups that are raising money with no business model, which is like weird. And that's like 7-year-old callback stuff. Like, didn't we do that one time? But I do see it as different in that respect. So.
Yeah. So you just hit on something that I was thinking, in that fluency point that you were making. And I, given all of the, startups that we're seeing pop up that are toting their AI capabilities, whether that they're brand new, or they're now adding AI as a buzzword to the capabilities they had built, you know, a few years ago, and just trying to take advantage of the cycle that's happening. Those executive buying decisions, how much of it is the FOMO, do you think? And they're trying, because they see it as a capability, they're saying, well, like what we're trying to get to, what's the balance between I'm not doing anything in AI and I'm going to be left behind. I'm going to move the swing the pendulum all the way over to AI can do everything for me, and that's what I want to implement, versus where can AI truly be impactful to the business outcome that I'm trying to drive towards, whether that's internal facing AI capabilities, external facing AI capabilities.
Yeah. I think it's a little different company to company. High level though, I'll give you kind of like what we see buyers, how we see buyers and sellers interacting right now around this term. So the buzzword kicked off. Now the C-suite, every conversation has to be about Gen AI. Many, many consequences. Let me count the ways. Number one, all the services firms in the world have kind of finally realized, and we see this in terms of who we work with now. So we work with a lot of the bigger IT services firms who are sort of looking at the clock and saying, jeepers, you know, in 3 to 5 years, I bet half our revenue has to do with data and AI. It seems like if we don't have a reputation for that stuff, that's going to be a tough business to run. And so that world woke up to it. They can pivot really quickly, and they're already in with the Fortune 1000, like deep in. Like they go to the guy's Christmas party every year for the last 12 years and play golf with them, like that level of deep, right? Startups don't play those games. Like startups got a long way to go to get there. So they're already in there. They can just switch the script and now start talking about the hot buzzword. So the services world is kind of vacuuming up a lot of the early attention around this stuff. Some of the platform players, like the Dataikus, are like big established software players like an SAP. I think they've got an opportunity to turn this into a big expand play. We're going to see how well they can do that. But I will say the services firms are already so deep in the game in so many departments. And this buzzword is so much hotter than some of the past AI waves with a higher level of fluency. I think they're going to convert most of the early cash, the services firms. The pure play Gen AI startups are not in the game right now. So in the enterprise game, they're in the game of a great looking Twitter demo. They're in the game of R&D. And I respect those things. I have nothing against those things. I think there is a little bit of an unfortunate fact that some of those companies raised money on the fact that OpenAI building the sand god was really cool and could be really powerful and amazing. And they sort of went in with like, we'll do that too. Right. So not so much like we'll solve X problem, just like we could also drink in data and do video and stuff. And at some point, money, right? Like, and by the way, somebody has to roll those dice. I'm not making fun of people for rolling the big dice, right? Somebody's got to roll the big dice, but there's too many of those dice rolling right now, in my opinion. And I think a lot of these guys are going to sort of either find a way to get into the enterprise, or like, you know, we saw, what's his name, Mustafa, get yanked up by Microsoft and pulled away from his little thing. we saw a stability guy, you know, get yanked in there among a bunch of beleaguered lawsuits and things like that. I think there's going to be some abandoning of these ships. They're hot ships, and building the Sand God is a big deal. But it doesn't look like a lot of business. So I think it's 18 months until the Gen AI wave of companies has enterprise ready products and has any go to market sense about themselves, sales teams, things like that, right? They're out of the game. So the buzzword's hot as hell. Enterprise can't even talk to the pure Gen AI guys because there's only like two or three of them that are really playing the game. All the other startups have had to pivot themselves to then Gen AI. It's a little bit tough. Honestly, I feel for them because it's a tough position. It's like, man, for the last 7 years, I've built these capabilities in retail, insurance, life sciences, whatever. And now nobody wants to talk about anything but Gen AI. It's like, that's not even what's going to solve this problem, but I got to slap it on my wrapper. It's like, it's hard to observe. It's a little heartbreaking for me.
Thank you for saying that out loud.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Nobody says that, but that's my job. So the forced rebrand is painful to observe. It's par for the course. I think it'll fade away. At some point, people will see that this is a rich tapestry of a variety of capabilities, and we won't have to be leaning on fucking buzzwords. But it's where we are right now. So that's what I see happening. I see services taking the first whack at the pie. We'll see how much of it they can get. Some of the embedded players will get it. Some startups are now getting boxed out of conversations because they don't have enough Gen AI. Some are kind of bending this forced rebrand in a way that works. And the pure Gen AI companies are not even in the game. There's no Johnson & Johnson and Walmart money and all this stuff for those guys. Relatively speaking, there's like functionally none of it. So that's what we see as buyer and seller activity in Gen AI right now.
That's a great picture of the landscape. One thing I've noticed talking about sort of the dead bodies is, and this is coming from scrolling LinkedIn and recruiters talking to me on LinkedIn, is the reemergence of the VP of AI role or managing director or whatever the flavor is in your company. In terms of strategy, does that type of role, that role never made sense before, in my opinion. Does that role make sense now as someone who owns that strategy if it is going to be a capability layer, or do you think it's still silly?
It'll depend on how it gets played. Like in other words, what rolls up under that person? How do they interact with and who? I don't think we've seen enough to have a firm take there. There isn't really a known playbook even now of what is it going to look like for this stuff to become embedded in all the different departments of, you know, an SAP, never mind all the different departments of a Geico. What is the center of excellence play and whatever? I mean, there's maybe some best practices being kind of felt out, but there's no like clear road for this stuff. So I guess my hope with the VP of AI sort of role is that they're as deeply embedded as they can be with sort of the technical folks they need to be in with. So like the chief data and AI officer, whoever that is, and then sort of the analytics and kind of the full IT stack crowd, like deeply connected with them and not an enemy of them. Because IT often has some resistance to this stuff. It's a lot more work and maybe it's a little bit cooler and that's kind of offensive. And then also the specific departments and sort of divisions and kind of boots on the ground workflows that they're ultimately going to be impacting, because it's obviously not AI for its own sake. So it's kind of how well do they get connected to the connective tissue technically that would like make them be strong and relevant and be able to carry weight. And then also how much buy-in do they have from the top as well to actually kind of fulfill on some mandates? And then how well embedded and connected can they be in those initial handful of departments where like we really could transform things if we focused and we put a strong shoulder into it for, you know, infra and kind of having a plan and being able to kind of work together on this. Can that happen or not? I think that would be my take on the VP of AI, at least right now.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
I want to change directions. This is usually not my role, but I want to point us towards insurance and finance a little bit. Sorry.
That's what I do.
Switch the tables. And specifically, you know, you talked about the first cash sort of going to the services company and then the the next layer of cash going to, you know, the larger tech players that are starting to add capabilities. I wonder if you'd go through those tranches and talk about like, okay, the cash is going there or is going to go there. What are people going to be buying, you know, in the insurance and finance sector specifically?
Yeah. I'll just tell you what we've seen. But again, we talked to a lot of the buyers and a lot of the sellers. So, you know, your whole ecosystem here. We saw initially Gen AI brought the initial pop of excitement, I think, was a lot of CX stuff. Whoa, we could like answer customer questions or whatever. That was the excitement, was that it can generate text. That means we could talk to customer, right? Like that was the instinct, right? But as we've seen, from our vantage point, there's not a lot of really robust, you know, department-wide Gen AI hardcore innovation within, let's call it most of finance, certainly most of insurance. But we do see like our pockets of like marketing people using it for creative tasks. And then we see our pockets of folks on kind of the technical side using it for sort of engineering related stuff, not really as part of a company mandate, but as just part of like, this is sort of easy. So there was a lot of excitement around CX. I think there's still a bunch of barriers to this stuff. You know, the hallucination deal is a big one. Temporal context on customers is a big one. There's all sorts of reasons why, even with the amazing, better than Turing, you know, technology we have now, extremely reliable customer interactions are just not in the cards, let's say, in the next 6 months, in my personal opinion. I could be proven wrong, but I think the level of context and kind of temporal knowledge and product baked in context knowledge that has to go into a customer interaction and how little you're allowed to really get wrong, I just don't think it's a tomorrow thing. So we saw excitement there, but then it fizzled. We saw usage pop up in dark corner of creative stuff, dark corner of engineering stuff. And then we've seen sort of the conversation start to settle where they were settled already. So for us, for insurance AI, for example, claims and underwriting, at least from our vantage point, has always been 70, 80% of the action in terms of enterprise AI in insurance. If we just look at like dollars spent, this is just our vantage point, kind of hasn't changed in like 4 or 5 years. It's still where a lot of the action is. So we're seeing stuff sort of settle back there. Companies generally, they spend money on defense. So anything that's like compliance and regulatory related, I think the dollars are still going to go there. And so like in banking, you know, anti-money laundering, fraud, any kind of regulatory stuff, communication surveillance type stuff, those sort of things. And then in insurance sort of underwriting and claims. So got hot for CX, bubbled up in some weird corners. The big conversation settled back to the frickin' problems where we as a big lunky enterprise company focus anyway. This has been our experience thus far.
You're saying everything that I'm hearing in the conversations that we're having as well. It's always comes back to what's the automation, what's the decision making that can happen in the underwriting workflows or in the claims workflows. But I want to go back to something you said, Dan, about the inherent risks, right? And so when CX popped up, and then you know it's a hot capability you want to execute, and then there's the concern about what if it goes wrong? You know that's where we want to interface with the customer directly. We should make sure that it's like the best interaction possible. Overlaying those needs, you've got obviously the compliance and the regulatory space that sits on top of all these major industries, right? And so I'll say insurance carriers are thinking about bringing in these AI capabilities, where do you think are areas where they can be more bullish and areas where they really need to be slower in their approach to implementing? And I'm this is a very wordy question for you, but I'm also thinking about it from the lens of you know, how restrictive should they be, or do they want to be before people start, I'll call it, going rogue and still using you know, AI and large language models, maybe outside of kind of the being compliant, because it is easier, because it is accessible now to people that are not just wearing the data science title.
And there's a ton in there, and I almost like, I feel like if I don't give you enough direction on what you ultimately wanted for detail in a corner, like just point me at the corner, but I'm just going to try to respond to the cloud of ideas that we just frothed up together. So, but it's all relevant stuff. So, we've seen some companies start to develop, a bit of a playbook and understanding of, okay, where do we believe this stuff has the most value? What do we think the relative risks are of these things? And then, okay, for this sort of department and set of use cases, let's have our sandbox where we're developing the capability, and then let's have the approved process for where it can be used. So different, let's call it different buckets have different amounts of risk. And then each of them needs some degree of experimentation to see if we can even get the freaking result we're looking for. And then if we can, well, we still need to figure out when that's the right tool or the wrong tool to use. So I think that's sort of 1, 2, 3 of like, where could we use it? Is it possible to get value at all? And then if it is, when and how should different people be able to use it? I feel like that 1, 2, 3 is sort of going to happen regardless of industry, insurance or otherwise. And I think it's a pretty smart order. And some of the companies, including the services players, frankly, are beginning to think along these lines. And I think it behooves most enterprises to do the same. So I guess what you're asking is, what are those buckets that are riskier than others? Maybe. I think it depends on, it's not even just like underwriting. It's like, well, there might be some parts of underwriting where this is wildly risky, and then other parts of underwriting mm-hmm. where this is wildly useful. At Emerge, we really think about junctures of workflows. So with our editorial, AI doesn't transform the call center. What did the workflow look like before and after? It didn't transform. It's not fairy dust you sprinkle on top of underwriting and the writing changes. It's like there's junctures of workflows. So maybe there's a part of some underwriting workflow where we need to summarize some big goofy document and like make some risk-informed decision about it. Maybe for certain kinds of documents, even though Gen AI is brilliant at summarization, we're still sort of missing something from scrolling through those 4 stupid PDF pages versus having the paragraph shoved in our face. It's more time consuming, but we're still missing something. It would be too high risk. But there might be other random arbitrary workflows in some dark ass corner of Allstate or Geico where like, yes, summarize it. Get the goddamn gist and move on. And so it's tough to say in, you know, underwriting generally high risk, low risk, cheaper, show me the damn workflow. You know, it has to be the juncture of the workflow. Same with customer success. There might be some elements of customer success where I've got somebody. So directly messaging customers could be dangerous. Maybe we don't want to do that right now. You know, voice interactions, answering questions, giving people pricing. Whoa, we probably want to steer clear of that right now. Pretty obvious. However, there might be some dark corner of CS where we've got teams and teams of people making sense of chat logs and transcribed, you know, voicemail calls and whatever. And we might be able to summarize the heck out of that stuff and even create charts and graphs. And the reliability is so strong and the risk is so low in terms of impact to the customer that it might be a brilliant use case for generative AI. So I would have to be pointed at a juncture of a workflow to give you thumbs up, thumbs down. And I think enterprises should think the same way.
Makes a ton of sense. I also think you were talking about the level of transformation and the risk. I think it's going to be a while before anything really high impact, really risky is totally given to generative AI, just because it is absolutely comforting to be able to fire someone if they cock it up.
Yeah.
There's something to that. And yeah, I don't think we have a good replacement for that with technology.
The VP of AI, obviously, responsible for that.
Yeah. Off with his head.
Hit it on him. Yeah. The sacrificial lamb of AI generally. Something goes wrong, chuck him out. That's that son of a bee. I'm with you. I don't think anybody's going to willy-nilly let go of the reins. In fact, I think they're going to do what legacy companies do. And again, I can't blame them. I think every kind of entity has its own incentives and behaves as it behaves. And I'm not making any judgment, but I think that they will be slower than they ought, because that's just how incentives work. And there's a lot of defense motives, and they'll be slower than they ought. So not only do I agree with you that we won't see them let go of the reins earlier than they should, I think they'll let go of them later than they should. And I think the only thing that's going to get them to let go of the reins, in my opinion, are 2 forces. Would love to know if you guys see some others. This is just how we think about it currently. We've got to see some startups potentially bubbling up so much more efficient, so much better customer experience, so much faster, better, cheaper, that they start eating the lunch of bigger companies in a non-trivial way. That's one thing. A second thing would be very digitally nimble competitors that start to do that same eating of their lunch horizontally, like on their side, their peers who start moving faster in certain like auto insurance or whatever, and are somewhat inarguably garnering advantage from that. When those two things happen, we think that the reins will be let loose, but they'll be kept legacy enterprise tight for as long as they can. Change will happen when it must.
Well, and I would argue, and I'm thinking out loud right now, but you talked about the growth being you know, the capabilities are growing really, really fast. They're going to continue to grow really, really fast. Okay. If that growth is truly exponential, then there really is no advantage to getting in early.
Well, I think maybe there's an argument to that. We could flesh it out. I mean, what I currently understand the case, we have an article called Critical Capabilities, so just EMERJ, Critical Capabilities. It's an infographic. Essentially, to make AI turn into ROI, we've got to be able to have skills and talent that are at least proximally connected to this stuff. We have enough data science fluency in our non-technical folks, enough data scientists that know our subject matter expertise areas. We've got to have that stuff handled. And there's a bunch of subcomponents of talent. There's sort of culture. We've got to be able to running experiments, even if this tech is monumentally better, five times more capable than it is today, we still have to have the stomach to be able to run experiments and have a way of institutionalizing, iterating and experimentation in a way where we can make progress. And there's all kinds of components to culture that we like to break down. And then there's the resources side of things. Our data infrastructure, like, it should at least be functioning. And we should have other kind of pipes and ladders sort of working in ways that will allow us to turn AI into a capability. If we sit on all of those things and then the tech is really good, we're still moving way too slow because now we got to jackhammer the data infra because we're starting from scratch. Culture still wants to treat everything like we spend money. I want to make money in 3 months, right? That's not an attitude that's going to work well with enterprise AI. And then talent wise, if we're way behind the eight ball, it's still tough. So like, I'm with you, but at the same time, I think there's so much to be done in those three clunky categories where like the chug away progress of building those capabilities if companies have been smart, not all of them have, all these lost projects, these silly innovation spin-ups should have at least built some of those three components. Those things should be a little bit stronger as muscles. That's the hope, is that at least we have a capability ROI, even if not a financial. And so I do think, Chris, that there's some there's some credence to the idea that those things should be chipped away on.
I will say the conversations I'm having about AI at similar levels to people you're talking to nowadays are very different than they were 6 years ago. The level of understanding, the level of eyes glazing over when I talk about certain difficulties has definitely changed.
So oh, absolutely.
I think you're right.
Good thing. It's a net good. The fluency is way higher than it used to be.
Yeah.
And you know, even if there's still so many goofy FOMO things happening, it's like we can at least be happy about that because I think it sets us up for better use of dollars and transformation moving forward. So,
yeah. So we've talked a lot about the insurance industry appropriately so, but I'm curious, what industry do you think Gen AI would be most impactful in the fastest? Like where would it make the most change or where would it be, implemented the quickest?
Yeah. I suspect to be proven wrong here because I don't have any crystal balls, but I will say I don't think we're very far from that full-blown immersive programmatically generated experience stuff. So I suspect that sort of media, maybe that's social media, digital media broadly, has just monumental, relatively near-term leaps in what customer experiences will be like. And they also lack some of the clunky legacy infra changes that would have to happen in order to bring those to life. Like if the tech's strong enough and Zuckerberg can pipe it through, Facebook, people will have it. It doesn't want to go through as much clunk as like a JP Morgan to impact some lending process or something. Not that I'm pessimistic about JP Morgan, I just think it's a different story. So I think there's huge change coming in that world. And I think there's a lot less barriers to it coming quickly. And I think they can make very good use of just the immediate cutting edge of the raw tech itself, to the point where let's say right now, if I want to feel relaxed, I'll walk outside, maybe I'll read a paper book. But I don't know how long it's going to be until I can strap on a headset trained on every single time I've been relaxed in the last 3 years. and my real-time biofeedback and eye tracking, and simply more reliably, more consistently, instantaneously fulfill that reward circuit of relaxation better than walking outside. Now, I'm not going to like disturb you guys and talk about like friendships or romantic relationships or anything like that. Wouldn't want you to like, I don't know, like really have to think about the future a lot. But
it's
like
a natural extrapolation.
Yeah, yeah. But I think any reward circuit from entertainment to sort of accolades, already we have huge swaths of the male population who are getting they have proxies for fulfilling certain needs, with video games for ambition or other kinds of online media for other kinds of needs, let's just say, right? And that's been good enough to pull them out of the working market and just escape into that world, because the proxies, ladies and gentlemen, are now good enough to at least scratch the itch. And if they don't have more ambition than that, it's at least good enough. I think we'll have genuine alternatives to the real ways of sufficing your needs, mm-hmm. not rough and ugly proxies, genuine alternatives. And I suspect that this is sort of not within our lifetimes, but like within the decade. And I think societally we'll want to wrestle with that. But in terms of near-term impact, I see that as outlandishly and wildly more impactful than what we're going to see in, let's say, logistics inventory management.
Yeah.
You say it so pessimistically, Dan, like it's not an exciting area.
yeah. I love logistics. Actually, I have a couple really good pals. I just got a coffee here in Boston with a guy who runs like a supply chain company. So, Paul, if you're listening, I got love for you, buddy. I just think it'll move more quickly, and we'll all, not just in business, but just in life, feel that hit a little bit quicker and faster in terms of change, impact, and adoption than we will in most of the legacy industries.
I mean, you have to wonder if you can craft your reality, and it does a great job of crafting it for you, how long is it before we're in WALL-E and you just sort of give the reins to the machine and say, just make me feel good all the time. Just adapt, right?
I got like entire TEDx talks and like 5,000 essays on exactly the answer to that question, at least from my vantage point, the possible panoplies of where we could land. But here's to your point. I think it's a tremendously good point. There's an ancient article, 8 years old maybe now, called Lotus Eaters and World Eaters. So Lotus Eaters and World Eaters. So the idea is as follows. As we can conjure whatever it is we want to conjure in real time, most people will eat the digital lotus. That is to say, they will swim in the preferable emotionally fulfilling experiences that they want. You know, 1998, Mariah Carey, hot tub, chocolate pudding, whatever you want to, right? Whatever that is for you. I'm not saying that is for me. That's definitely, I have no interest in that, by the way.
It's not what I heard.
For the record, no interest. But some, you know, sick people might, right? So, but I think everybody's got their own preference of what that looks like. If you can feel the social accolades of being an achiever and you can get everything else from these worlds, I think eating the digital lotus, the lotus is already so appealing, we're losing big chunks of men. Japan has this whole thing called hikikomori that people can Google. America has its own shebang of this. The proxies are good enough to be yanking ambition out of the real world. I think that fight hasn't even started. So I think most people eat the digital lotus. There is another class of persons who will use this technology to augment themselves in order to be vastly more productive. So conjuring forth what the next steps are, making it gamified and fun, and staying connected to the shared human world in a way that's sort of, let's call it joining the state of nature and competing in it digitally, rather than escaping the state of nature digitally. Those are sort of the two paths ahead. And I think societally, there is a major question where in the United Nations and the OECD, I'm kind of beating on this drum, and it's not a drum a lot of people have listened to. I suspect maybe in the next couple of years they will, that we really should think about what percentage of, are there ways to bend with innovation and regulation, ways to bend ourselves away from a 90% escapism sort of ratio? Because I do think it's going to be tough to be a productive society if the WALL-E shebang becomes real. Those are actual concerns. You're asking questions that, in my opinion, warrant asking immediately.
I just don't want all my kids to have to move back in with me after college.
Yeah. there's that. There's actually bigger concerns than that, but yeah, that's one of them.
Yeah.
One of them. Yeah. You should make sure that
for others, not for me.
Make sure that they're as productive as they can be, Chris. So you can get a little bit of that empty nest time to be in your own VR husk. enjoying stuff on your own time. You know what I mean?
Yes. Well, and keep encouraging ChatGPT for homework.
Yeah, exactly.
Push that on.
It begs the question, do we get it to a point where productivity is not important? Maybe creativity, personal creativity becomes the more important thing. I don't know.
I'll hit you on that. So I think it is a delightful notion that we could have all of our needs met by some vastly greater intelligence, and we could mostly focus on being fulfilled. Now, humans, you know, this vessel is not necessarily built for fulfillment, right? You and I live like gods, but day-to-day hedonic tone is pretty equivalent, maybe worse than our grandparents. So we've got some issues at a hardware level here, guys. I hate to break it to you, right? But unless we get to the hardware, we're not really solving sort of fulfillment. I also think it's a tough game to hope that we'll be treated as piping plovers. So where I live, there's a species of bird that nature has mandated to perish, but that we have decided to keep alive with tax dollars and save certain parts of the beach so that they can do whatever piping plovers do. And I'm sure it's lovely stuff. I've never seen them do it, maybe once or twice, but I'm sure it's great stuff. I don't have any preference for them above rock doves and hedgehogs, but the tax dollars definitely do. But I would say that species, who on its own is out, lives in a precarious spot. And I don't think it should be entirely our wish. I think it's a lovely wish, but I think it's a bit dangerous to hope that we are as fruitless, because we will live at the behest of those things that are fruitful. And so it is not my personal wish. I do think it's a possible future. I don't advocate my friends move in that direction, personally.
Well, on that note of recommendation, this has been a fascinating conversation with Dan Fajella, the CEO, head of research at Emerge AI Research. Dan, thanks so much for joining us. This has been awesome, awesome conversation.
Glad to hang with you guys. It's been a real blast.
I have to go do some soul searching now. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Unstructured Unlocked. You can find all of our episodes wherever you listen to podcasts today. Be sure to write a review if you like what you hear.